I'm Christopher Lydon, back in the Glasgow pub at long last with Mark Blyth. He is the Sean Connery version of an economist who sees the money games in politics and the power games in money. And he's got a book out this spring that is hot as a pistol called Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude. It's 3 or 4 years now, Mark Blyth, that you and Paul Krugman and others have been bashing this austerity idea, the idea essentially that countries can cut their way back to prosperity, cut pensions, services, educational expenditures, that sort of thing. And still, it seems to be the ruling idea in lots of Europe, and it's got a foothold in the U.S. Congress, too. First, just a scorecard on this dangerous idea.
Well, the scorecard is simple. First of all, it's nice to be back in the pub. Normally, we'd say Glasgow rather than Glasgow, but I will allow you the Americanism. Anyway, point is, all right, so think about it this way. 4 years ago, a bunch of people, myself included, on Radio Open Source were saying this is ludicrous because what's going to happen is the following. Imagine you got a bunch of debt. And then you got an economy, and your economy is the thing that's going to service your debt. So let's cut the thing that's going to service your debt. And let's have lots and lots of economies that are all interlinked, all sharing the same common currency, and none of them have their own printing press. So they can't devalue their way out of trouble, they can't inflate their way out of trouble, and they're all going to cut at the same time and expect to grow. Well, this is, you don't have to be a Keynesian, you don't have to be a neoclassical, you don't have to have done a single class in economics. Basic arithmetic would tell you that this is nonsense. So imagine that the government is, say, 40% of the economy, as it usually is in Europe in general. And let's say you're going to have a 50% cut in government expenditure. You're going to wipe out 20% of GDP. And that's what they've done in southern Europe, 30% in Greece. And the results have been horrific. So what's the scorecard look like? It looks like this. The United States, due to its bizarre 19th century, actually 18th century constitutional setup, has been unable to cut anything. There's been a positive side to gridlock. And because of that, the United States has had a recovery. It could have been stronger had there been better interventions, but at least they didn't do anything bad. They didn't start putting the leeches on, which is basically what they've been doing in Europe. And because of that, there's a recovery. This year, the end of the year 2013, the deficit will be around 3%. And that means going into 2014, the debt will start to be reduced because growth cures debt. Cuts do not do that. Now let's look at the Brits. Brits are sitting there, got all the same advantages as the US. They've got their own currency, a real central bank, they can intervene, all that, a big banking crisis. Where are they now? End of this year, they're going to have about a 7% budget deficit. And they're going to have more debt than when they started the crisis. Why? Because they've been cutting in the middle of a recession. And they have the advantage of having their own currency to cushion it. Now let's go to the Eurozone. 22 million above normal unemployed. 20 to 30% of GDP destroyed in the southern economies for absolutely no reason other than ideological bigotry. That's the scorecard, Chris. It's pretty horrific.
We got to get into the psychological roots of this vaguely puritanical notion that we should just punish ourselves and we'll feel better or something. Because you say that is as strong as the ideology or anything else. But I just want to review the bidding. I mean, what we've learned from you over the years is that this cursed debt is mostly private debt, sucker's debt in a sense, bailout debt that the public here and in Europe was conned into assuming from the banks, who were considered too big to fail and all that. Secondly, that the cuts in public spending are fundamentally unfair. They hurt students, they hurt the retired people more than a lot of others. But also that this general retrenchment, as you're saying, makes the slump worse. My sense is you don't have to be as smart as you, Mark Blyth, to get it. People sort of are on to the fact that there's something weird here. That the bankers are running our lives. The Troika tells Portugal what it can and cannot have. How does this persist?
So think of this as a giant insurance policy that society has written against itself. So over the past 30 years, we've allowed the people at the top end of the income distribution to basically financialize the economy. Now, what do I mean by that? Allow your banks to become multiples of GDP. run huge leverage ratios, which basically means for every buck you've got in reserve or as common equity you can burn through in a crisis, you've got 30 or 40 out there as loans and other speculations. Now, let's assume that you get outsized rewards at the top. And as we know, most of the rewards for the past 30 years have been going up to the top 10 or top 5 or top 1%. Meanwhile, on the bottom, the income skew goes the other way. For the bottom 40% of the income distribution, they haven't had a real wage increase in about 25 years. It's actually now with the crisis up to the 50th percentile. Now, what does this mean? It means that you have this highly unequal society. Why is that important economically rather than politically or socially? Because people at the top, and there's very few of them, and they have all the assets and resources, don't consume enough. There's only so many Porsches you can buy, and one person only buys so many cans of Campbell's soup. If, on the other hand, the people at the bottom don't consume enough, then you have, in the context of a wage squeeze where the credit card bubble has gone and Chinese deflation through Walmart is disappearing, you've got too little consumption at the bottom. Now, when you have this big crisis, what happens? The insurance policy is this. You guys get to have all the outside rewards so long as we get the tax revenue, and the tax revenue smooths the income distribution. But then the tax revenue disappears in the crisis. It becomes public debt. Private debt from these banks that were too big to fail becomes public debt in the balance sheet as you bail them out. Go back to 2006. US debt to GDP was 61%. Do you remember any congressmen jumping up and down the Congress screaming about the awful, terrible national debt we had at that point in time? No, they were celebrating how we were all making money out of our houses as if they were ATM machines. Nobody gave a damn about the debt at that point. And then we bail out the people who have all the assets and all the income, i.e. the financial sector and the people who are heavily invested in it, and we reinsure their income so they don't fall in any way at all, and it creates an extra 30% of public debt. Oh, look at that terrible debt crisis. We're up to 90%. Well, Mr. Rogoff tells us we're all going to die at 90%. We have to start cutting now. Well, who do you cut? You're cutting the people at the top? No, they don't consume government services. It's the people at the bottom who are going to get their shtick for this. So imagine, basically, you write yourself an insurance contract. It goes bad, you cash in the insurance, and the insurance policy then, guy who writes the policy turns around to someone else who's got nothing to do with it and says, you need to pay for the insurance payout. That's what happened right across the developed world. It was a gigantic bait and switch.
So we talked before about the fundamental unfairnesses here, but your book takes it up several notches. I mean, you say now in retrospect that it was austerity, not inflation, that gave the world Nazism. You say it was austerity in Japan in the 30s that started their expansionism, that this is not just about being nice to students or elders. It's there's dynamite, there's deep poison in here. Explain that and make that case.
Yeah, sure. The last time we tried to take the five largest economies in the world, the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, France, and who else? United States, United Kingdom, Germany, France, and Japan, of course, and shrink them all at the same time was in the 1920s. So in the 1920s, the idea was get back on the gold standard, right? Then we'll have really sound money and we'll get trade going again. Well, the problem with that is basically what you're trying to do is keep your exchange rate at a certain fixed value, and the price of doing that is to generate a lot of extra unemployment. So when you're doing this, your economy is shrinking. So your budget deficit goes up. So you're on the gold standard. You can't actually run big budget deficits. You're not allowed to, how the system works. So what do you have to do? You have to start cutting. So you start cutting. So the United States, when Hoover basically does his tax increase in 1931, unemployment goes from 8% to 23%. You have the Brits coming along in 1926, go back on the gold standard, generates an extra 2 million unemployed almost instantaneously over the course of 12 months. So then you get into the 1930s, the countries concerned say, oh, enough of this, start falling off the gold standard. But you think that that would actually relieve the pressure, but it doesn't. They keep cutting. So the British government, cutting the whole time, in 1931 has 170% debt to GDP. By 1933, it has 190% to debt to GDP, despite the cuts. It's exactly that dynamic I was talking about, whereby if you have a common stock of debt and you shrink the economy, the debt's getting bigger, not smaller in real terms. Now, when you're doing this, the politics of this, with so much unemployment being created in countries that don't have developed welfare states at that point, get really ugly. So let's do the German story. So the standard German story here goes like this. Well, it was terrible. We came out of the war and we had this high inflation. And then the government just lost it completely in Weimar and they started printing money. And then everybody lost their savings. And then Hitler arrived. No. That's not happened at all. What actually happened was the German government knew that 40% of their GDP was going to be shipped off to France for the next 20 years under the terms of the Versailles Agreement.
Called reparations or something.
Yes, reparations. So they basically had to pay back 40% of GDP. Now, if you wake up in the morning and know that 40 cents out of the dollar that you're going to earn is going to go to the French for just, you know, so they can have more pâté, what do you think you're going to do? So basically what they did was they decided to gum up the financial system. And a really good way of doing that is to run a deliberate hyperinflation, which is what they did, because it basically devalued the Deutschmark to the point that they couldn't earn enough gold marks to pay back the debt. This worked so well that the Americans came riding in, rewrote the reparations payments plan, and made war credits junior to private credits in the agreement at the time, which was called the Dawes Plan. What did this mean? It meant that the Germans were off the hook for paying the French for about 4 or 5 years, and as much money as you can spell flowed from the United States into Germany. Between 24 and 28, the German economy was one of the fastest growing and most stable of all the economies in that time. None of them were doing great, but Germany was certainly not falling off a cliff by that point. Along comes 1929. There's a thing called the Young Plan. They switch that seniority in the agreement between private credits and war credits. Suddenly, the French are like, oh, oi, Deutsche boy, give me the money back. All the American money goes flying out of the country because they realize they don't have creditor protection anymore, and they're all taking advantage of the Wall Street boom. All the money in Germany disappears. What happens? At that point, you get this guy called Chancellor Brüning, because the Social Democrats step to the side just as they're doing today. And he comes in and he says, I will balance the budget no matter what. So he slashes and he slashes and he slashes. And there's a minor party that was getting single figures in the late 1920s called the NSDAP. And as he cut and as he continued to do this, they went from single figures to 13% to, I think, 23% to 33%. And if memory serves me right, by 1934, by the time that they were the last election in Germany, they got 43% of the vote. The hyperinflation ended 8 months after it started in 1923, maybe 24. The Nazis came to power in 1931 and consolidated their hold in 1933. There's a big gap in the middle. You know what happened? Austerity.
Mark, come back to this country today and the responses to our own financial crisis, which isn't all austerity. George Packer has been writing interesting stuff in The New Yorker and now in a new book called The Unwinding. Among other things, he asks, why haven't victims of the new depression come together in a mass movement, something like the Bonus Marchers or the Townsend Clubs of the past? His answer is, after decades of global competition, the biggest difference from the 30s, American workers have a sober appreciation of their relative unimportance in the grand scheme. What's the Mark Blythe take generally on a kind of political apathy around palpable distress?
I wouldn't take the line that there's a sort of a reasoned position that your average worker has, whereby they're pricing themselves relative to global competition. It's a bit like economic models that assume people make all these calculations when in fact they don't, and that's why they get it wrong a lot of the time. I'd say it's a simpler one. If you spend a lot of time basically taking your unionization rates from about 1 in 5 workers down to about 1 in 8 workers, where we are now, then you don't have any institutions for collective action or collective recognition that people commonly join. You have very flexible, to use that nice neutral word, labour markets, which means it's very easy to get hired and it's very, very easy to get fired. So it's great on the upside and lousy on the downside. Mm. So if you have bills to pay and all the rest of it, as everyone does, then you will be rather conservative in your wage demands if you're lucky enough to have a job. And if you don't, you will try and do what you can to price yourself into a job. And the United States has certain advantages over other societies in that regard. English is a common language coast to coast. People move around a lot more than they do in Europe. And you see some of that in the pickup in the labour market that we're beginning to see now. It's still high by historic standards. This is still a very sclerotic recovery in terms of past recoveries if you compare it to that. But I'm not at all surprised that, you know, without having institutions that foster collective identity and collective action, that people find themselves alone and looking to themselves for individualistic solutions for what are much more collective problems. But let me link it to another point. It is kind of where we're back to now. I mean, one of the things about the 1930s we discovered, which we of course forgot, given the way that we rewrote economics education over the past 30 years, is that it was a crisis of consumption. You basically had a very... The Great Gatsby's out as a film again. Go yeah, see it, right? But think about it, right? I mean, so basically you have this tiny elite, right? How many yachts can they buy, right? And they have all the goddamn cash. And they don't need to invest in a recession because they can live off the interest of their investments. So they're fine. Everybody else is screwed if you don't have investment. They can't consume enough because of the wage skew. We're back to where we were in the 20s and 30s.
Explain this Obama impasse with the Tea Party Republicans in Congress. What is the core of their feeling, do you think, and what's wrong with their idea?
Well, what's wrong with the idea is simply that, you know, it's nonsense that the country in the world that has 14 aircraft carriers, 5 battle groups, has developed a technology which means in 10 years it will be a net oil exporter. It prints the global reserve asset that everybody else needs to earn in order to conduct foreign trade, and the yields on its 10-year bonds are below 2.5%, somehow has a debt crisis. This is just garbage. It's simply not true. As for the famous sort of 90% thing in the Reinhardt and Rogoff paper, well, you know, you didn't need to go through the econometrics to figure out there was something wrong when the one country that was growing was the United States, whose debt was above 90%, and there were countries who had debts below 90% who weren't growing. In fact, they were shrinking in the Eurozone. So obviously there's a pile of nonsense embedded right within the ideology. But partly this is an old story. I mean, why do congressional Republicans of this flavor exist? Why have they existed all the way right through from the New Deal period through the John Birch Society era right up to the Tea Party now? Because fundamentally they're anti-statists. They fear the growth of the state. So any excuse, whether it's through tax policy, whether it's through the retrenchment of budgets, whether it's through the creation of a debt crisis, their job is to slash the state. Now, they may be doing it. I think Ryan sincerely believes what he says about if you free up a dollar from the government, in a sense, you get N gajillion dollars of private investment because it's no longer trapped in the dead hand of the state. Quite how that works, I've never been sure, because imagine a situation whereby a university gets a government grant and then they basically buy a computer. The computer is used to process a grant application from a scientist who's employed at the state university. He invents a molecule which a few years down the line becomes something that revolutionizes biotech. All of that is a deadweight loss in the libertarian worldview, right? Complete waste of time. Meanwhile, if you give the world's worst author goes into the Mac store and buys an Apple, that somehow adds to GDP because it's private sector, right? I mean, just this, the imbalance in this ideology is just astonishing. But nonetheless, you know, you have a basic position that it's markets good, state bad, and they will try and, to use the Grover Norquist line, continue to drown the state in a bathtub if they get the first possible opportunity. Mm-hmm. So this is just the latest iteration of state bashing, and it's nothing new, and, you know, it continues. Now, how have we resolved this? Why is it the United States is growing? Well, part of this is because the Republicans in Congress haven't been able to enforce cuts. By the same token, the Democrats haven't been able to spend where they would like to. And it's not at all clear that short or, you know, continual stimulus in that sense, year after year after year, really has the bang for the buck. So in a sense, there's a kind of Hippocratic economics, first do no harm, right? And that's where the United States has landed itself. And it's a recovery of sorts going on. Now, let's go again and look at the situation. You know, why is it the United States being able to do this? Because we have Uncle Ben Bernanke. And regardless of all the sort of bad stories about quantitative easing and so on and so forth, he did what a real central bank can do. You reach into the banks that were causing the problems, you take all the crappy assets off their books, you call them something like Maiden Lane 2 or the Term Loan Auction Facility that nobody ever looks at or understands, you stick it on your balance sheet, you give the bank lots and lots of cheap money, and you say, get lending started, raise some common equity, rebuild your balance sheet, and get out there and do what you're meant to do. You kickstart the financial system by taking the crap off, delevering the banks and starting it again. That's what Ben did. The ECB can't do this. It is actually not allowed to do this. It can't mutualize. It's not a real lender of last resort. So what has it been able to do? Well, by inches, through the replacement of Trichet by Draghi and others, they've done all these things called LTRO, which is a huge liquidity pump, SOP to keep the banks going, because their banks are still filled with all those crappy assets that ours got rid of a couple of years ago. So what have you actually got in terms of governance institutions in the world? Let's move away from Obama and what Obama can do, or any of these people like that. And let's think about the following. America has fiscal institutions, but they're gridlock, so they might as well not be there. Europe forgot to build them. Europe has a fake central bank. It's a currency board with a liquidity pump and an inflation target, and it can't mutualize debt, it can't clean up the financial sector, and it basically can add liquidity, squeeze, and pray. That's what they do. The only functioning part of the global economic governing architecture is the US Fed. That's it. Hmm. So why is it the Fed's been doing all these things and doing quantitative easing and all the rest of it? Because there's nobody else around to do anything else. One set of fiscal institutions are gridlocked, one set doesn't exist. So all you're left with is Uncle Ben's giant, colossal global asset swap. And you know what the weird thing is? It might have just worked.
Surprise. The last question, Mark, goes back to what we learn about you now, that you were a welfare kid from Dundee, who's done awfully well in Scotland and now in the American land of milk and honey, but that your kind of career is the model of social growth, human happiness, prosperity, development, making rich lives out of poor, etc. When does that notion of a social democracy, of a common prosperity, and the public institutions that make it possible, when does that kick in as a driving force in all of this stuff? Leave the economic theory and all the numbers aside. How do we rebuild the society, and when does that urgency take over?
It takes over when people began to demand it again. So I was recently at a conference in Atlanta, and I was given a shtick where basically I was pointing out the data on income distribution and underconsumption, and people at the top don't consume enough and all the rest of it. And basically I was saying you need to pay more taxes, and those taxes will somehow be redistributed, and, you know, it's very social democratic and all that. And, you know, it was in Atlanta, and a couple of guys are like, no way, dude, basically. And, you know, you get your hands on my money, you pinko, and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, he says, you know, well, this is nonsense. Isn't the real problem, you know, the collapse of the American education system? And he got a round of applause, you know, for saying that. And I said, all right, let's think about why it collapsed. So it must have been about 800 people in the room. I said, how many of you are Americans? 500 hands up. So how many of you went to a state school? How many of you went to, like, a, you know, a public school? I said, 400 hands went up. I'm like, great. So you're all relatively well-off people. Now tell the truth. How many of you sent your kids to private school? 3/4 of the hands stayed up. So, well, there's your crisis in American education. If everyone with the income, the connections, the talent, the know-how, the work ethic, and everything good in society decides to opt out in their own private solution, why would you expect the state schools to continue to function? You guys opting out is the problem. It's not the tax revenue or any of that stuff, or maybe, but it's also the fact that you don't care anymore. And if you don't care anymore, why should anybody else care?
And you had the nerve with your accent and everything to say that to these good Americans?
I certainly did. And after I was chased with pitchforks from the building, no. You know, but I mention it as an example of, you know, the curious what we think about this. Let's go back to my own experience. So my mother died when I was very young, and I was raised by my paternal grandmother. Basically, all we had was her state retirement pension and occasional handouts from my manual worker father, who was a butcher. And that was usually in the form of in kind, like bits of dead things were dropped off at the house on a Friday. And, you know, we made our way through. And as I say in the preface, it's really, I actually went to school with holes in my shoes. I really did. So, you know, I then go to university and all the rest of it and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, you know, I did this because of all these state-funded ladders of achievement that were there. The schools worked. If you were smart enough, you got in. There were grants available, blah, 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 all this sort of stuff. You didn't have to have complete financial records. You didn't have to go miles into debt to do this, et cetera, et cetera. And that was it. And people say to me, well, you know, it's good for you doing that, but, you know, somebody had to pay for that, and you're just basically taking from others and, you know, enjoying yourself. Well, my answer to that is, you got to be kidding me. Do you know how much taxes I pay now? Now, think about it this way. Suppose I hadn't exactly advantaged myself through the education system. Supposing I'd stayed in Dundee. Well, I probably would have been in the military, which is a huge tax loss. Or I would have been in jail, which is very, very expensive. Or I would have been basically a marginal worker. And I would have paid very little taxes in the public purse. Instead of which, I come over here, and as somebody who's done pretty well, I pay a lot more taxes over my lifetime than I ever took out in the welfare expenditures. This stuff pays for itself. It creates an equal society. Mm. It creates the possibility of mobility. It creates the idea the ideal and also the belief that it is possible to succeed. And we are dangerously close to creating a world where those ladders of mobility and that belief, that all-important belief that's so important to the legitimation of capitalism, is going away. We have a winner-takes-all society where those who can opt out do, and those who are left behind do what they must. That is what worries me. That's where the scary politics start.
I'm a great fan of Tony Judt, who is a kind of Eastern European Jewish London version of your Scottish story, but he grew up and to great eminence in this country and the world on public transportation, public health, and public education. Why can't we make a cause of this, as you've just beautifully outlined?
Because those who are most able to make the cause have private alternatives. And those private alternatives, until they become prohibitively expensive relative to their incomes, will be what they avail themselves of. So think about it this way. I'll give you an analogy, right? So air travel, when it was regulated back in the bad old days of regulation, so a lot of people didn't go to by airline. They went by bus or train or whatever because airlines were expensive. And the way that airlines used to compete was on things like fashion, right? Remember all the Pan Am stuff and food and all that, because it was regulated. You couldn't compete on fares. So then comes deregulation and everybody can fly, and now we all have to line up for 2 hours and they have bits on our ticket called SLC, you're known as self-loading cargo for some of those airlines that are out there, and the service is crap and everything's terrible, whatever. So how do you make that better? Well, you make it better for the people who can afford it. So the ones who travel a lot, they get status and they have a special line, and the people who can pay more, they get the nice seats at the front. And I fly a lot on British Airways. British Airways now has 4 classes in its planes when you go transatlantic. It's the medieval class structure brought back to life. At the front, and the very front of the plane where you turn left rather than right, when you're coming in the nose, right, yeah. First class, that's the aristocrats. The other ones you never get to see. You don't even get to see these people, right?
Ladies.
Literally the lords and ladies. Then when you turn right, you go through all these flat lie-down beds. These are the transatlantic knights of the financial nobility, right? And then you get past that, and then you get to premium economy, which is kind of like, you know, the serfs with money. And you notice how that's a very, very small section of the plane. And then 1/3 of the airframe has 2/3 of the passengers. Cattle. Cargo. Self-loading, everybody else. It's a bit like the societies we've built for ourselves. And until the people, not at the bottom, but the ones in the middle, the ones whose voices matter the most in politics, say, you know what, I just can't afford $50,000 a year for whatever Ivy League university or non-Ivy League university. How am I going to do it? Let's say you earn $150,000 a year. You pay your taxes, you're coming out with about $115,000. It's a lot of money. It's 3 times the median income, right? You start with 150. You've got 115, you pay your bills off of this, all the rest. You've got a chunk of change. Let's say you've got $60,000. Well, you've got to eat. You've got to do a couple of things. Let's say you save $40,000 of that. That's still not enough for 1 year at college. And you wouldn't get financial aid because you're earning 150. I know professors at these schools that can't send their kid to these schools. And that's if they have one. What if they have two? So when that constituency starts to say, hang on a minute, there's something seriously wrong here, that's when you begin to see change.
Mark Blythe, it's a joy to have you back in the pub. And thanks also hugely for this wonderful book, Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea.
It's always good to be here. My only question is this. If this is the pub, why are there no drinks?
Coming up. Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation with Mark Blythe. He's professor of political economy at the Watson Institute at Brown University. This austerity argument isn't over until listeners like you add your 2 bits in a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the project.